Hi, this is Lisa Costa-Beer. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where I'll be talking to Todd Mansfield on Candida overgrowth as a cause of unexplained gut symptoms. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode.
Welcome to FX Medicine, bringing you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present, and extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. The gut biome is one of the most fascinating areas of modern science. Over the last few decades, we have come to understand its impact on mental health, obesity, autoimmunity, neurodevelopmental disorders, and more. The gut biome is a key target for whole person health. One of the most common issues I have seen over the years of practice is gastroesophageal reflux. So, with this in mind, I invited my very esteemed colleague, Dr. Arun Dia, a modern-day gastroenterology surgeon and clinical researcher with a passionate interest in the gut biome and how it impacts the functioning of the upper gastric systems. Dr. Arun is also an author of Happy Gut and Healthy Weight, which outlines the role gut health plays in achieving and maintaining your healthy weight. He also regularly publishes his newsletter and blogs and was recently published in the Herald Sun with his latest article, Seven Types of Hunger. Welcome to the show, Dr. Arun.
Thank you so much, Michelle, and thank you for the organizers for inviting me.
Wow, I feel like I'm talking to a local rock star, Arun. What a fabulous offering you have given your patients. Firstly, I wanted to start by asking you where this passion began, because many surgeons often ascribe themselves as kind of a plumber and can tend to be less interested in the functioning of the systems that they actually operate on. So what happened? Is there a story behind what sparked your curiosity?
Well, I think, Michelle, as you and I know, there is always a story, right? things just don't happen randomly, you know. And I think I will go back a few years, showing my age a little bit here. In 2010, when I started at Monash Medical Center, that is the time when I started my private practice as well. And I truly believe that, you know, our patients are our most powerful teachers. And we are all being pushed into difficult situations as treating clinicians to kind of find the answers that to the problems that our patients pose for us. And that sort of was something that sparked my sort of journey in this space. I was always curious about, you know, how could we do better? How could we sort of improve our outcomes and results? So that curious part of me was always there right from my childhood. But when I started my private practice, there was this one patient who wrote a letter to me. She's a, let's call her Anna for the sake of privacy, which is not her real name, by the way, but she's having long-standing issues with obesity. BMI had reached up to 52. She's a mother in her mid-40s of three beautiful kids. And I got to know her as we went along the journey a little bit, came to see me with her husband. And prior to her coming to see me, she wrote me a letter, and the letter really explained, you know, what she was going through. It was very unusual. Normally, people would get a GP referral and then would come and see a doctor.
Sure.
But she actually wrote the letter and went on this journey with me, and clearly she needed something done about her weight, which was the biggest challenge that she was facing. Eventually, went on to have a gastric sleeve surgery, and I thought, you know what, she'd lost all the weight, and I thought, look, great job. I kind of knew about it. However, 4 years down the track, she came back again to see me, and her weight had regained. And that was a big blow. I kind of knew that this happens. I wasn't ignorant about it. But to happen for my patients with all the sort of knowledge and expertise that I could provide to them was a big blow to my own ego. And these things are very humbling. And they, as I said earlier, you know, they cause us to look deeper. And in 2016, which is probably about just a year after she, or just a few months actually after she came to see me, I was due to take my long service leave. So when you work in a public system for 10 years in Victoria, you get, the government gives you 3 months of, you know, paid leave. And or you could take it for 6 months as on half pay. The thing was that I was wondering, what do I do? Shall I do, my options were to do more private practice or to attend more
Have a holiday, Arun.
I know, that was on the cards as well, but the kids were young at that stage, you know, so that kind of, you know, I just couldn't go away without them. So anyways, I decided to take the gut module of ACNIM because I was kind of, you know, I have to do something different. I was one of those people, I was just wanting to say, you know what, let me look outside the box. As to what is causing, where does the problem lie? And there was this one quote that kept coming up from Hippocrates, the father of medicine, who said, all disease begins in the gut.
You were like, bingo.
And I know. And that was like a light bulb moment. And I kind of, you know, growing up as a kid in India, where Ayurveda or herbal medicine is still practiced in different shapes and forms, I kind of knew that gut health was really critical. But we were treating it with probiotics and drinking kombucha here, you know, and that's not how it is. Like, in fact, if you go to Baker's Delight, you get the prebiotic bread these days. And I said, wow, what a commercial twist we have put on the whole thing of gut health. And I'm not blaming any commercial organization, but I do believe that we need to empower ourselves with true evidence-based knowledge. So I felt that, you know, if disease can begin in the gut, well, health can begin in the gut as well. So that started my journey. I went into learning yoga, meditation, and became a certified teacher with Yoga Australia in yoga and meditation, because I truly believe there's a mind-body connection. I knew it. But I think to be able to educate and empower yourself and train yourself was a key element of, you know, allowing me to be able to speak my voice without seeking the favorable opinions of others, especially from my own surgical community, because I was just going to be like, you know, blacklisted or, hey, you just shut up and sit down because we know these things don't work. Surgery can fix anything.
Exactly. And also, I mean, I think it's Hippocrates as well, but it might have been someone else, which is heal thyself. And because I'm really curious about this upper digestive issue that we've got with such a rise in the use of PPIs, you know, the medication that is being used for reflux and heartburn and Barrett's esophagus, et cetera. Why is reflux and heartburn so common? And what's this underlying mechanism? What's the most common underlying mechanisms that allow these symptoms to present?
Yeah. So just to give the listeners a little bit of a context, gastroesophageal reflux disease is one of the most common complaints in general practice. And it is estimated that 1 in 5 people actually experience symptoms of GERD or GORD, depending on whichever country you're in, you can say gastroesophageal reflux disease. 1 in 5 people experience it on a weekly basis. And the sad part is that majority of them just treat it with over-the-counter medications because it just gets ignored. Now, the thing that you asked is, why is it so common? Well, there have been many studies that have been done on it in terms of, you know, the sort of causes of reflux and all that. But here is what it all boils down to. It boils down to the mechanisms that are impacting the competence of the lower esophageal sphincter, which is the lower 5 centimeters of the esophagus. And the lower 5 centimeters of the esophagus is actually called the high pressure zone. And that normally remains closed to prevent the reflux or the acid from coming up into the esophagus. Now, the esophagus can handle the acid for a brief period of time as long as it gets pushed down. But it is the long-standing sort of acid when it goes into what we call a stasis. That means it just stays in the esophagus, is when it starts to create damage. Now, this could be acid, it could be bile, it could be food, it could be anything. You know? So it's important to recognize that there are anatomical and physiological factors in play. And there's not just one reason, you know, there are multiple factors, like the anatomical, we call them the sling fibers of the crural pillars, which maintain the competency of this valve. And I'm just naming just one of them over here. So the raised intra-abdominal pressure, the pressure difference between the chest and the abdomen, which maintains the patency, because this lower 5 centimeters, or let's call it the lower 3 centimeters of the esophagus, is intra-abdominal. It is in the abdomen. So now what is happening is the profile of, you know, the human beings is changing because of a culture of convenience, comfort, and also overconsumption. Our classic patient, the gastroesophageal reflux patients, and this is the one that I get worried about, is generally the obese male. This is the obese male who is smoking, who loves a steak and a jug of beer, and has got a comfortable lifestyle, and more importantly, is also on medications such as antihistamines, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and medications which are likely to increase the acid production and diminish the mucosal barrier that is there, and also leads a high-strung life.
I was going to say, like, stress is, you know, is pretty ubiquitous in this modern culture as well.
Absolutely. No. So coming back to the factors that cause gastroesophageal reflux, all of these conditions have increased in our society, and it is compounded by an overconsumption of ultra-processed foods. Now, ultra-processed foods, we know that they create an acidic environment in the body because of the chemicals and the pesticides and the herbicides and the preservatives and the coloring agents.
And the salt. And,
correct. Yeah. So all of that creates an acidic environment in the body. And the more acidic environment you have, you can easily test it by your salivary pH. And even there was a very good talk that was delivered over the weekend at the integrative conference, was around how the oral microbiome and the oral pH are so interlinked. Our body loves an alkaline pH.
Yeah.
We thrive in an alkaline pH, but when the body turns into more acidic pH, it leads to all sorts of problems. But the bottom line of all that is inflammation.
Yeah.
And we know that inflammation is the root cause of so many conditions besides gastroesophageal reflux.
So is it too little acid or too much acid? Because we know that these PPIs work, you know, as a GP. You know, when you put somebody on something like a Nexium or a Somac, it generally their symptoms go away. Yet there's so much kind of talk about whether it's a hypochlorhydric environment or
correct. And again, this is where there is no one answer that fits everything. Now, I'll give you an example. You know, for example, if there are conditions in which the body is actually producing a lot of acid, hyperchlorhydria, and that is a condition in which, say, excessive production of gastrin hormone, there are gastrinomas that are pancreatic tumors, which can actually cause the stomach to make a lot of acid. So each condition is different, and I can't generalize that every person with gastroesophageal reflux should have acid replacement, or every person should be on suppression therapy. Now, it's an easy fix, and of course it is an easy fix, because as I just explained to you, when there is more acid that is coming up the incompetent lower esophageal sphincter, it is going to stay for a longer period of time in the esophagus, creating that sensation of heartburn. So the problem is not so much the acid in the stomach. The problem is the incompetent valve in that situation.
That's brilliant. So that's such a good way of kind of looking at it as well, because it just adds a whole new lens on top of our ability to treat these conditions.
Yeah, it's very hard to say that one size fits everyone, and that is never the case. We know that. So I focus on some baseline investigations that any GP can request, can order, or can do in their own sort of, you know, rooms, like things like, you know, a barium swallow. Now, barium swallow is an X-ray that can be ordered by a GP. It gives you a baseline study of both the anatomical and physiological features of the esophagus and also the esophageal gastric junction, which is the lower esophageal sphincter. Say, if you've got tertiary contractions that you can see in the esophagus, well, that itself is a dysmotility. These patients will still experience symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux or gastroesophageal reflux-like symptoms, but they will not respond to Nexium. Why? Right. Because there's a problem with the muscle coordination of the peristalsis of the esophagus.
So what do you do in that particular case? Like what's your favorite treatment for that, apart from, you know, I mean, obviously losing weight and changing diet is going to have an impact, but is there something even more, I guess, direct that you like to favor?
Are you asking specifically about the dysmotility, esophageal dysmotility?
Yeah,
or tertiary?
That's right. Yeah?
Well,
yeah.
Okay. So we are talking about motility disorders of the esophagus. These are like the achalasias, and, you know, there are various other conditions which could be related to systemic connective tissue disorders, like scleroderma, for example, has got an affiliated CREST syndrome, as we know, and it has got esophageal dysmotility as a part of it, you know. But just say, for example, some of them have got surgical treatments, some have got non-surgical treatments. For achalasia, we know that there is a surgical treatment available, but one has to advance to that level to be able to be eligible or qualify for a surgical treatment, which is an esophageal cardiomyotomy. So, which does produce good results. But again, not for everyone. There are other alternatives that have come up which are minimally invasive, endoscopic, thoracoscopic. Now, I know I'm going into details as far as just one line of pathological condition is concerned. But broadly speaking, once again, I think you have to start with a baseline assessment and then progress to actually defining what is the condition and what is the reason why this individual has got reflux. So I always work on local factors and systemic factors.
Yes.
That's how I believe in my practice, that's a philosophy or an algorithm that I have developed. That I share with my patients.
Yeah, it's a good way of looking at it because you kind of zoom in and you zoom out. So you're looking, you know, in the minutiae, and then you're maximizing it out to sort of the whole systems aspect as well.
Correct.
But I wanted to ask you about, you know, hiatus hernias, because I often find with that, you know, you can have small ones, large ones, you know, people often, you know, they might come in with a small one. And for me, I guess my intuition sort of says, I think we're just kind of, you know, having to sort of accept the fact that you've got this gastroesophageal reflux condition because you've got a small hiatus hernia. I feel like there's more to it than that. Like, what's your opinion on hiatus hernias in the sense of, like, I mean, are they as significant an issue, and why are there so many of them?
Yeah, okay. All right. it's a good question, because and I also believe that there is a dichotomy in how we manage these between surgeons, physicians, and even naturopaths. You know, when I attended the ACNEM gut module, there was like, you know, I was probably the only odd person in the whole class, and they were talking about fixing treating hiatus hernias, not fixing, but treating hiatus hernias with you know, hypochloric sort of acid replacement and things like that. So, which was a very let's call it a counterintuitive thought for me, because as a surgeon, I've been trained to fix hiatus hernias, and that's what I do. So let's just take a step back. And in answer to your second question, what you said, why are there so many hiatus hernias? Well, there are two main types of hiatus hernias. One is called the sliding hiatus hernias. Other is called the rolling hiatus hernias. And the key difference between the two is that in sliding hiatus hernias, the gastroesophageal junction, which is the point where the food pipe joins the stomach, has actually gone up into the chest. So it actually pulls a lot of the upper stomach into the chest. Whereas the key distinction between the sliding and the rolling is that in the rolling hiatus hernia, the esophageal gastric junction is still in the abdomen. Just one wall of the stomach rolls up alongside the esophagus and goes into the chest. Now, one creates significant symptoms of reflux or vomiting, or as we call as volume regurgitation, whereas the rolling hiatus hernias produce mostly compression symptoms. So, you know, they create more chest pain. They create more dysphagia. In fact, I've had several patients who have been referred to me initially by the cardiologist who found the rolling hiatus hernia in women who were experiencing shortness of breath on an echocardiogram. They said, what is this gas-filled structure sitting behind the left atrium? And lo and behold, you do a CT scan, you find the stomach is rolled up into the chest. And you know, the funny thing is, Michelle, you fix their hiatus hernias and their shortness of breath is gone. They say, wow, I can breathe now. So the point I'm trying to make is that one treatment, once again, cannot fix every problem of reflux.
Why is there so many hiatus hernias? Is this just an obesity problem, or is there more to it than that? Like, is it an intra-abdominal pressure that's pushing it up into the chest? Or
yes, the short answer is gastroesophageal reflux disease and obesity are interlinked. We know, especially men, truncal obesity or visceral adiposity, as we call it in technical terms, creates a raised intragastric and intra-abdominal pressure, which causes the gastroesophageal junction to sort of get pushed up, but it is also combined with lower esophageal sphincter pressures, which creates more reflux for obese males, especially when they are lying down at nighttime after a big, heavy, cheesy, greasy meal, because the damage takes place at nighttime, but the symptoms are felt in the morning during the daytime. So that's kind of, you know, where the association between obesity and gastroesophageal reflux, and not just that, it is the progression of gastroesophageal reflux to Barrett's and to esophageal cancer has been published extensively in many journals. It is a known association, not just of any esophageal cancer, specifically esophageal adenocarcinoma.
Right. So that leads me on to my next question, which is, of course, about Helicobacter pylori, which is thought to have an association as well. An amazing discovery, you know, by our colleagues out in the West, by that incredible example of being their own science experiment. And so we know now that we know about this particular bug, that it affects 50% of the world's population, but not everybody is symptomatic with it or not. Is it really the nasty bug we think it is, or does it behave differently under different circumstances? And what do we need to know about the quality of this bacteria? Is it more about the bug, or is it more about the milieu in the famous Pasteur's
type? Yeah, and it's a great question, and I will be honest in saying that, you know, sadly, we don't have all the answers, Michelle. And again, it goes back to, you know, the first principles, you know. I truly believe that there is, you know, evidence in Helicobacter eradication as a part of the overall treatment protocol that one might have in managing gastroesophageal reflux disease, because there is association between H. pylori and acid peptic ulcer disease. association between H. pylori and dyspepsia and also gastric adenocarcinoma and specifically lymphomas, gastric lymphomas. So I would not challenge that. And I think that that is an acceptable sort of strategy. The challenge becomes when we start to treat randomly, like a blanket thing that, yes, there is H. pylori, you've got symptoms, here you go, first-line eradication therapy doesn't work, urea's breath test is still positive, there you go, second-line treatment or repeat of HP7. I think we are not looking deeper. And perhaps part of the reason is that we don't necessarily have all the answers available to us. And this is where I go back to first principles, as I said. The first principles really are that your gut microbiome is always changing.
Yeah.
If you tested somebody's gut microbiome, and I get patients who have done these exotic, expensive tests, DNA analysis and this and that, and I believe in testing. Don't get me wrong. That I'm not trying to say that I don't believe in investigations. I absolutely do. But when it comes to gut microbial assessments, I feel that perhaps we still don't quite understand how rapidly it evolves. For me, it's like, you know, going to watch a movie and taking a snapshot of one part of the movie and judging the whole movie based on that one single photo that you took.
I feel the same. I mean, as an experienced clinician, like I have used them multiple times myself, but you do sometimes leave kind of thinking of like, well, really, do we know enough? I think that they can be helpful in, I guess, getting patients sort of on board as a motivational tool as well and can give you some clues. But yeah, I have to agree with you that it's so fascinating and so complex that, you know, coming back to general principles always feels like a good place to start.
Yeah, it may be boring, I understand. People are looking for something exciting, you know, tell me something new, you know, like I get that.
That's so true.
But I think that's where our creativity needs to come in to be able to deliver the message that let's honestly accept and acknowledge that, look, we don't understand it as yet. And yes, we have got theories around it. As to, you know, how this bug is working, and because it's clearly not pathological in every human being.
Yeah.
So the thing is that it's pathological only in certain human beings. It is same,
so
like,
it's
you
opportunistic
know, COVID,
in a way, like a Klebsiella and like a Clostridia.
Correct. Same as COVID, you know, COVID bug infected so many people, but not everybody died. Not everybody landed up in ICU.
Yeah, so, and some people didn't even have any symptoms.
Correct. And therein lies this is my belief system again, you know, and this is how I approach it, that therein lies the power of what is your internal milieu? How is your internal environment? Because it's always an interaction that is happening, right? Your external environment and your internal environment are always interacting. If you're already inflamed, and I'm giving the example of COVID over here, well, we knew that why there was such a high mortality in America because of their highly processed diets and, as they call the SAD diet, the standard American diet. They had an inflamed system, and when COVID infection happened, they were obese, these people were diabetic, they had metabolic syndrome. It led to what we call a cytokine storm, which is basically an inflammation that has gone haywire.
That's right. I mean, it's a great way to look at it, to sort of even a way of kind of understanding. But I wanted to stay with just the nitty-gritty for a sec, because I know this is a question that I've had for a long period of time. So with H. pylori, sometimes when they've got symptoms and, you know, I've treated it and then, you know, the urea breath test comes back and it's negative, but there's a positive fecal antigen, you know, on one of the other tests. Like, I mean, what do we do when we get these kind of conflicting results and there's asymptomatic aspects? I kind of just get conflicted with, like, what should I do with that information? And, you know, how relevant is that to my clinical decision making?
Correct. So I'll answer that question in two different parts, right. Michelle. The first part is that, you know, I do believe that there is certainly a relevance of endoscopic assessment, you know. Yes, we are doing the blood titers, we're doing the antigens, we're doing the urea's breath test and all of that. But I think it is critical to be able to have an endoscopic assessment of how the endoscopic appearances are looking like when we are treating somebody who has got symptoms that may suggest that they have still ongoing gastroesophageal reflux disease. So because we know, endoscopically speaking, you could have a spectrum of conditions. It could be on one spectrum, you could have erosive esophagitis, which is ulcerated, strictured, and all those sort of things based on the grades. But you could also have non-erosive reflux disease, which is, we call that NERD for the want of a better word. Oh. But, you know, it is non-erosive. Yeah. It's like, you know, the patients have symptoms, but they have got, you know, essentially the Helicobacter just seems to be an opportunistic infection that is present. So that's one side of things. Also, let's not ignore that there are conditions like eosinophilic esophagitis, which are getting so common.
So common. I didn't even hear about that in medical school.
Yes,
you know,
exactly,
it was like,
you know,
not, it was so rare. It was, like hardly mentioned.
Correct. And presenting with the same symptoms, but has got different treatment. Now, coming to your answer about, you know, specifically about H. pylori treatment. See, I would, of course, have a follow-up correlation with your endoscopic assessment, because the last thing you want to do is you don't want to be missing something. And a gastroscopy is something which, in my opinion, you need to have a baseline. You need to be able to repeat it if the symptoms are significant. Or you are not getting the results with H. pylori eradication, not only for reassurance for the patient, but to make sure that there are no other conditions that are being missed.
I think
there is something, and I think there is something to be said about testing the antigenic, you know, sort of the fecal antigen that you're talking about. But there is also something to be said about actually taking biopsies, which again goes back to endoscopy. You know, when you take a biopsy of the area that you are may or may not be concerned about, it will give you the relevant information to be able to provide you with the information to reassure your patient.
So we talk a lot about the gut biome, you know, and obviously the quality of the gut biome and how diversified it is, and you know, how inflammatory it is, and this metabolome. So what impact does the gut biome have on H. pylori in the stomach, knowing that there is this, one of my favorite things about gastroenterology in medical school was the gastrocolic reflex, you know, so when you
gastrocolic reflex,
the gastrocolic reflex, and then learning about the gut biome and how that can impact the gastrocolic reflex. And so do we know anything about that, and is that a consideration to work on the lower gut biome quality to help with GERD and H. pylori?
Yeah, exactly. And I think therein lies what we were talking about, you know, base principles. Like, you know, okay, let's talk about things like constipation. Constipation is, we know, is a manifestation of, you know, I think if I remember my learnings from the gut module correctly, it is because of certain bacteria that produce more nitric oxide, which cause temporary paralysis of the smooth muscles of the large bowel, creating more constipation, which is the unfavorable bacteria that are proliferating. Now, the thing is that constipation, we know, also worsens the symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux.
Yeah.
So it is not purely just mechanical. It is also how, you know, the internal hormonal changes and the microbial changes happen. The other aspect is about the research in the space of gut microbiome and gastroesophageal reflux disease. Now, we are in the process of putting in an ethics submission for assessing exactly this, that can changing the gut microbiome by use of probiotics in this case, and in individuals who are undergoing anti-reflux surgery, does it impact their outcomes? So we are taking a cohort of patients who are undergoing anti-reflux surgery for gastroesophageal reflux, of course. And we are giving one cohort a specific probiotic, which has been developed by one of the pharmaceutical companies on a trial basis purely, to see whether impacting that does make any difference.
One of the things that, you know, I work closely with nutritionists and naturopaths and even myself looking into the treatment of these H. pylori infection, and mastic gum is such a touted treatment for it. You know, it comes from Greece, it's a herbal remedy, and the role of vitamin C seems to be of assistance as well. What do you think of them? I know that the research is never as strong because of usually financial limitations in natural medicine. But they seem to actually clinically be of assistance. Well, I just was curious as to what you think about them.
Yeah, and look, I will be honest in saying I have, thanks to my patients who educate me, that I have to kind of learn this myself. I have heard of other treatments like licorice, DGL.
Yes. Now, and marshmallow root.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Apple cider vinegar.
Yeah.
Again, for treatment of gastroesophageal reflux. The sad part is, Michelle, that, you know, we know that there is a role for complementary treatments, but there is not enough evidence for us to say, you know what, this has, maybe it's a subject for us to look at. You know, I've even seen acupressure, a use of melatonin being used for, I've read articles while I was preparing.
I've seen that too,
You know, but the sad part is that we don't have enough sort of, you know, robust evidence to say, you know what, yes, this thing definitely works.
I guess we don't have the robust evidence to say this hasn't been compared to this, you know, in that standard placebo-controlled trial aspect. And I guess when we look at these interventions, it's based on a functional intervention in the sense that, you know, that it's this functional issue when you're looking at, okay, melatonin, we know that there's melatonin receptors going to you know, I guess, relax the digestive system and you know, the level of safety is high with those things. And like vitamin C, for example, is very alkalizing, so we know there's a lot of acid, or that excessive acidic foods make these problems worse. So what happens if we were to give alkaline agents, et cetera? So, and I think that coming back to that basic principles, that's where it comes down to, okay, well, we need to change lifestyle and can we add in something else that's going to come along those first principle basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And we can always do that. And just sort of sharing with you a little bit of my algorithm. My algorithm really is that if an individual has got reflux symptoms, we need to start with some baseline investigations. And some of them include endoscopy, barium swallow, a routine set of bloods, perhaps even a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis.
Yes.
And they may need further, you know, what we call as pH monitoring studies, like, you know, 24-hour monitoring pH study and high-resolution manometry, which is to test the esophageal function. Now, these are, you may think these are very detailed investigations, but I'm just talking about some investigations. The whole purpose of this is to define whether there is actually a hiatus hernia or a mechanical failure that can be corrected. Or is it something which is going down the path of there is no mechanical failure, we need to go down the non-surgical or the medical path. And therein lies, you know, lifestyle, reduce the toxins like alcohol, smoking, caffeine, and work on specifics like stress and sleep management, you know, processed foods versus alkaline foods, you know, introducing more alkaline foods, managing your weight. We know when the weight goes down, the individual's reflux symptoms improve.
Absolutely. So, and your first kind of point with hiatus hernia as well is the tightness of the diaphragm. So in my work, as you know, I do a lot of mind-body medicine, but people don't breathe well. You know, people breathe, particularly with chronic anxiety and chronic stress, and
shallow breathing,
even burnout, they shallow breath. And that's not giving the diaphragm any time to relax. So the diaphragm gets very, very tight and can be a problem as well. So a lot of these softer elements of medicine, which is not so dramatic as surgery, are in fact probably working on those mechanisms that we really want to.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. And I think this is where education and empowerment comes in, evidence-based information, which, you know, and I tell my patients, look, I'll bring this to the table to heal you. But you have to bring your own sort of, you know, commitment as well to be able to help us once we have arrived at a diagnosis. Because let's be honest, it is a teamwork.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't be there to do every meal with them. And, you know, society's pressure on certain food choices are extraordinary. But I wanted to, you know, one of the things that I've found with people coming back with gastroscopes is this kind of recording of low-grade gastritis.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, it's so common these days. And I wanted to also talk to you about eosinophilic esophagitis as well. Why do you think that that is the case? I mean, are we just seeing the level of inflammation, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, well, I think there is an association between eosinophilic esophagitis and celiac.
Right.
Now the thing is that, you know, celiac disease wasn't as common probably 4 decades ago, or at least, you know, yes, it was known, but we weren't seeing it as commonly. The same goes for allergies and food intolerances. Now, when I first heard about intolerance or an allergy to avocados, I was like shocked. I had never heard of it, you know. In fact, I'd grown up in a country that didn't even recognize peanut allergies, you know. So what I'm just trying to say is the overall observation, and of course this is an observation only, that either we are seeing more of this, there is a rising incidence, and we are also developing tools to test more of this. Mm. I just find that there is a rise in our intolerances, autoimmune conditions, allergies. And I believe that eosinophilic esophagitis, this is probably my belief, and yes, I could be criticized for this, but I'm openly saying this is just my opinion, is a small representation of this overall big picture thing which is developing in the background because of a disrupted biome. Like, you know, you see the hunter-gatherers, and I mentioned this in my book as well, that we had such a diverse and a rich biome because of the variety of the food categories that we were consuming. As every revolution came in, like the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution, that biome got shrunk to narrower and narrower spectrums to a point where, like, our gut biome is depleted.
Yes,
that richness has gone.
And also with the environmental toxins and pesticides, and they're really a problem that, you know, we haven't seen the likes of, you know, 100 or more years ago. So they can be hugely problematic.
Well, Michelle, just on that note, if I can say that, you know, I was so sobered to read about a study that I've actually just posted on my LinkedIn account as well, is a study that came from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, a very well-respected institute, that actually said that the current generation is the first time in the history of humanity that the current generation has got a shorter lifespan to its predecessor.
I know, I've heard that for many years. It's quite a scary and sobering thought.
I mean, this is reality, and I think in many ways we are kind of, you know, we shouldn't be leaving the world worse off for our kids who we so dearly love.
That's right, and I think that comes down to, like, you know, that the completely whole person care, because it's not just about the individual. When a person actually heals themselves, they'll often have positive ramifications to things like children or partners or siblings or parents. You know, there's usually a flow-on effect, like wellness breeds wellness, and that can be a really empowering thing for people as well. And when you start to look at whole person care, so if you start to look at your stress management, you may actually start to heal, you know, emotional trauma or you know, these big things that have transgenerational impact. So there's a lot to the ownership of health. I think we forget about healing the one person and how powerful, you know, that one person intervention is. But Dr. Arun, it was such a pleasure to chat to you today and listen to your wisdom and your mission. Thank you for sharing your wealth of knowledge. We're so many pearls to really think about, not only just specifically, but really broadly as well. Thank you for all you do and coming on your show, and really good luck with your books and blogs. And we'll have a link to all of these in the show notes.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for having me on the show and allowing me to share my thoughts and ideas. I truly believe that we are all collectively growing, and it is important to talk about these things, and the forum that you have created through your organizers. It's a very rich platform to discuss these ideas. So thank you again.
Thank you everyone for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine website. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse, and thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine. And share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.